Welcome to Power Play. On a day when the political battle cries were briefly silenced in the House of Commons during a moment to remember tragically hit frontman Gord Downie.
For a moment of silence in honor of the late, great Gord Downie, and I invite members to stand.
Now, clearly emotional, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had this to say about his friend.
And he wanted to make it better. He knew, as great as we were, we needed to be better than we are. And that's why his last years were devoted to Cheney Wedjack and to reconciliation. This is something that I've certainly drawn inspiration and strength from. And we are we are less as a country without Gord Downie in it.
Well, after the tears and after the silence was broken, the opposition parties went on the attack with the still-absent finance minister's reputation under siege. This coming on the same day as he walked back on a blanket ban against certain types of tax-reduced investments inside personal corporations. Coming up, a crisis communications expert sizes up the prime minister's handling of the ethics scandal which threatens his finance minister. And we put that latest tax policy reversal on those passive investments to the smell test with Canada's Chamber of Commerce president, and we will discuss Quebec's new law against face coverings on buses and in all public buildings with McGill's Dean of Law. But first, opposition fire and fury was aimed exclusively at the missing finance minister, so Justin Trudeau stepped in to protect Bill Morneau during question period. After all, it's best to talk to the prime minister.
What they were actually doing this whole time was protecting wealthy millionaires and those trying to hide it.
Instead of selling millions in Morneau Chappelle shares or even putting them in a blind trust, the finance minister chose to stuff them into a numbered company. He personally owns one-third of this company, while the other two-thirds are owned by a second company. And who owns that second company? The finance minister does. And two-thirds, other than a finance minister, in a whole mess of trouble.
Yeah. The finance minister worked with the Conflict of Ethics Commissioner, followed her recommendations and advice, and has continued to.
All right, let's call in the MPs with fresh concerns and, well, maybe some new answers. Marco Mendicino is a Liberal Parliamentary Secretary. Candace Bergen is the Conservative House Leader. Rachel Blaney is the NDP Seniors Critic. Welcome to you all.
Thanks.
Marco Mendicino, you're a reasonable man. So I'm
curious
how a finance minister who owns $40 million worth of shares in a company that can be influenced by files under his control isn't in a conflict of interest. Could you explain that to me?
Because he sat down with the ethics commissioner at the very commencement of his term. He worked very closely with her. He was advised by her with regards to his business interests, and he followed that advice. And you won't hear, I don't think, from either of my friends, except maybe in the House where there's parliamentary privilege, that he's broken the law, because he hasn't. And so while there's a lot of unfortunate criticism in the politics of personal attack, when I do think we can be doing better in the House, mm-hmm. What I think Canadians care about are things like cutting, small business tax, okay, and cutting taxes
for
middle.
Child benefit.
No, but I think that part of this is distraction, right? Part of this is ad hominem. And, we'll let the opposition do their thing, but this government is going to continue to be focused on important work.
Has he broken the spirit of the law, if not the letter of the law, Candace?
We have a finance minister who has been making decisions for the last 2 years that affect the finances of this country and affect corporations and companies. And now we find out he is making decisions that affect the corporation that he has, not in a blind trust, but he is not only knowing about these shares in a company, Morneau Chappelle, while he's making decisions. There is not a greater, what looks like a conflict of interest. Now, the Liberals have done this before. They have said, listen, we're following the law when it comes to cash for access. There seems to always be the desire for the Liberals to find the loophole and then drive right through the loophole. So the hypocrisy, while they're accusing small business owners of using loopholes to avoid taxes, we have a finance minister who is not only using loopholes to avoid taxes, but he's using loopholes so that he can then govern and be in a conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest, Rachel?
Well, I think Canadians know that this is highly, highly questionable behavior. And, you know, our ethics critic has sent a letter to the ethics commissioner and said, you know what, we need to really look into this. We need to get to the bottom of this. We know that average, everyday Canadians don't want to see this in their politicians. You know, the reality is Canadians are placing a fundamental trust that this minister will look after the finances of Canada. And right now we know the reality that he put forward Bill C-27.
And explain that, what that is for our viewers.
Well, this is about pensions. And so now we know that he's done this and he's making the legislation and his business will benefit from this financially. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, there's just too many questions. And I think it's shameful that the Prime Minister of Canada is saying that we're being petty and that this is just politics. This is a real important question and Canadians deserve better.
Marco, there's an old saying that in politics, perception is reality and the truth is negotiable. And I'm curious, isn't this a clearly perceived conflict? And shouldn't Mr. Morneau take the move that he's promised to go to the Ethics Commission and say, let's talk about putting this in a blind trust?
Well, to the extent that there's perception, it's being driven by, you know, what are distorted facts and just false misrepresentations.
Well, what are the distorted facts?
Well, I think the distorted facts are that somehow he's run afoul of the law. He has not.
Does he own $40 million
and
worth of shares?
He has
is
not.
Is he going to make
profits
from what he's
I was
going to
complete the thought.
You said you're lying. What facts are being distorted? Does he own $40 million worth of shares in Morneau Chappelle?
The assertion that he has broken the law is
That's
false.
That's not what we're saying.
It absolutely was made in the House, where you know members know that they can get away with a lot more than outside of it.
That are wrong.
But the facts are that he did sit down, work closely with the conflict of interest commissioner. None of the facts
have
changed.
They're not denying that fact.
None of the facts have changed. And they're also, I don't think they're going to deny the fact that the conflict of interest commissioner did advise him to take certain steps, which he followed. And therefore, he has not broken the law. And so,
high standard. High standard there with
well,
the
And
the
you know what? With regards to higher
asked,
standards,
yeah,
the finance minister has written the conflict of interest commissioner and has said that he is prepared to go above and beyond whatever the existing standards of the law are. And I think that is
minister.
A responsible thing to do. It's also consistent with the person that I know, the person that I work with, someone who has tremendous integrity, somebody who cares about Canadians, and somebody who is achieving agenda which will benefit everyone.
Candace,
again, the utter hypocrisy on so many levels. I mean, again, let's get back to what this was all about. This is a government that introduced tax changes to penalize small business owners, saying, you know what, they're using these loopholes and they're cheating the system. And you look at what the finance minister has done. So according to law, the finance minister has had 120 days to either put his assets in a blind trust or sell them off. Now, he found a loophole. And he created a number corporation that's in Alberta and put all of his shares. And I think Nathan was able
to hear the irony,
can
though?
There's an irony there. The irony. Do you hear the hypocrisy?
Well, the irony
now,
is...
Can I finish now? Thank you. Let's add to that. And we, you know, we've had other ministers in conservative governments. There's current ministers in the Liberal government that realize if they are going to be making decisions around policy that will affect their interests, they step away. That's called character. That's called, maybe it's not the law, you know, according to your definition. It's called doing the right thing.
Rachel,
and this minister didn't do it.
What should Bill Morneau do to get out of this trouble? What would satisfy the NDP?
Well, you know what I think is really important is we should be talking about the fact that this government has gone after small businesses. And what we've asked for repeatedly is let's look at who's hiding money offshore. Let's look at those tax loopholes. Why aren't we looking at the people who have significant amounts of money and making sure that they are also paying their fair share? So now what we're seeing is a minister that's doing the same thing, using those loopholes to not fulfill his obligations. And, you know, this is a conflict of interest. And I think it's shocking that we're not actually accepting this and that the Prime Minister feels very comfortable saying, no, he wrote a letter, he's done everything. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's time we start looking at some of these issues because this is what Canadians are concerned about. And small businesses have been under months of stress. And this is the result.
Talk about talking points, though. I mean, these are regurgitated arguments, which we've been hearing for months now, and they're ineffective because we've reached over the opposition and actually listened to Canadians. They told us about wanting lower small business taxes. We've done that.
It took you over two years, and it was a promise that you were not going to follow through with. If the criticism is we took the time to listen,
then that's something that I think that this government will adhere to.
Marco, let me drag this back to the issue I'm trying to talk about. Justin Trudeau, who has far less money sloshing around than Bill Morneau, said, I'm going to put my assets in a blind trust. I'm going to keep them at arm's length. What's good for the prime minister? Surely that's got to be equivalency to what the finance minister should do, because he does have some bills in the works and have passed in some cases that certainly would have a connection to Morneau-Chappelle, which does retirement and pension planning. It seems to me a little more clear-cut with the finance minister, doesn't it?
Well, not every...
Am I missing something?
I think what the responsible discussion that is occurring right now, which is a good one, is not every member of parliament has the same business interests.
Right. True.
And so that's why it's incumbent on the individual member to sit down with the conflict of interest commissioner, to work with that office.
I think it's ethics commissioner, the conflict of interest and ethics commissioner is the full name, but the ethics commissioner
to work with them to get advice about how to govern oneself once one takes office. That's what the minister did. And so this isn't a gotcha moment as much as my friends would like it to be, because he took all of the diligent steps that were required of him. And not only did he do that, but now he has said he's prepared to do more.
Right. Well, because she said, actually, Mary Dawson sat in that chair yesterday, Rachel, and said, you know, if I'd had my way, a direct or indirect control of these shares would be sufficient to call it a conflict. But right now, the act reads direct
and
only.
As a result, he has not broken the law.
Right, there we go. He wiggled
through it. That's a fact. Bottom line,
we have a government that is in a mess. They have a minister of finance and a government who has imposed taxes on small businesses. There was a massive rebellion against that. So they, you know, tried to back down. Still, jobs are going to be lost. Small businesses hurt. While in a parallel universe, they are jumping through loopholes and hypocritically hiding their money. We haven't even talked about Barbados, and we haven't talked about other ways that the finance minister is covering up and being able to protect his assets. This is a big problem for the Liberal government. Marco, I know you're here doing the job that you're asked to do. Your government needs to say this is wrong. The prime minister needs to tell the finance minister to get his affairs in order.
I'll tell you what, I am very proud of our record. We're going to have 3% GDP this year. We've created over 400,000 jobs since taking office.
Right.
We've seen unemployment come down to 16.
He's going to keep making laws that will help Morneau-Chappelle?
That's a record that I think we should all be proud of collectively, and one that I hope that you get behind.
He's made millions of dollars.
Rachel, I want to talk quickly, if I could, about the tax plan today. The announcement Bill Morneau actually made it in a faraway town in New Brunswick rather than face the music here. But anyway, it does raise the cap, the threshold for these passive investments to like $50,000. It basically says it's going to apply only to the very wealthiest companies. Has he not made the right move on that, in your view?
Well, you know, I just have to say, we are watching a government that knows that it made a significant mistake. The approach that they took was very disrespectful to small business. And I know in my riding, people have been pouring in our doors to talk about this issue because they are the backbone of our communities.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's a step. And I would love to hear from small business what they think, because it's got to be done, and it's got to be done.
Yeah, listen, as I said, small businesses, jobs are going to be lost. This is still a penalty and a slap in the face to small businesses, and this is because the government has been caught doing the wrong thing and under immense political pressure kind of changed their mind. It's still damaging, and they still it shows their true intentions. They cannot be trusted.
Short answer.
Absolutely. We've listened to Canadians. We've lowered small business taxes. We've listened on retirement security by creating the $1 million cap. We have ensured that when it comes to intergenerational sales, people like farmers aren't going to be impacted.
That's tomorrow's announcement.
And I think these are all going to be really, really positive steps towards encouraging growth in the economy, which is exceeding expectations.
But I just want to point out that that tax is not going to be in effect till 2019. Okay. So that was a promise of the election.
It's going to take until the mandate.
Frankly, I wouldn't trust a thing they say on taxes.
Thank you all. Very stimulating, interesting discussion, as always. Talk to you again next week. Coming up, a crisis communications report card on the Prime Minister, and business tax damage control keeps rolling out. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, as expected, perhaps, the opposition parties dedicated almost an entire question period to hammering the finance minister over failing to put his investment assets into a blind trust. The prime minister delivered every answer during his first House of Commons appearance this week.
He followed all of her advice and indeed has recently asked her if there's more he can do to go above and beyond what she originally asked of him. We know that hardworking small business owners deserve all the support we can get because they create jobs, they create economic growth. We're proud of the work the finance minister and this government has done to support small businesses right across this country. We will ensure that Canadian-controlled private corporations not used to reduce personal income tax obligations for high-income earners rather than supporting small businesses. That is the promise we made in that election campaign. That is what we are doing.
All right, let's get the crisis communications report card from an expert in the field. Jennifer Stewart is president of Syntax Strategic, a communications firm here in Ottawa. Welcome to the show, Jennifer. Nice to have you with us. So the prime minister, I guess, was trying to project calm confidence, and yet he certainly went back into a repetition mode, giving the same answer and over. Is that work?
It's kind of crisis communications 101. Oh, you know, stick. You didn't know that, did you? Stick to your key messages. It also may surprise you, most Canadians don't watch Question Period.
What?
Shocker. I'm shocked. What he's trying to achieve here is sticking to the same messages, and while they seem redundant during Question Period, it ensures that the media picks up on the clips that he wants to get out there. So he wanted to get out a few messages. You know, from his party's perspective, the minister stuck with the advisement of the ethics commissioner. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that plants some doubt in the minds of Canadians. Did he or didn't he do something wrong, right? And that's positive for the party. And then he really tried to get across the fact that the opposition is throwing mud or mudslinging and sturdy politics. Mm-hmm. Whether that's true or not, those were the two main points that Trudeau stuck to today and certainly wanted the media to pick up tonight.
I know, but is the repetition of a non-answer work when you don't really have a decent answer? Is that what you're doing here?
I think it's a bit transparent. Mm-hmm. I think they need to work on their key messaging. I think, you know, even though they're sticking to their sound bites, Canadians want and expect more. So if I were advising the Prime Minister, yes, stick to your sound bites, but let's elaborate them a bit to address the issues that, you know, Canadians really want you to touch upon. There's a lot of questions and there weren't a lot of answers.
Do you think you looked a little flustered when I kept calling it the conflict of the conflict of ethics officer? I mean, that's...
Again, I'd advise him to say ethics commissioner. You can't screw it up. Yes, he did.
Almost Freudian in a way.
Yeah.
He did get a little emotional when he started accusing the parties of petty politics and gutter politics. And I just wonder, at what point in time do you admit that there may be a problem here? Or do you just ignore it and keep moving on and stick to your script?
I don't think you ignore it, but I think it would be more damaging to show internal division within the party at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are really relying on the ethics commissioner's approval of Bill Morneau's, tactics in terms of not putting his assets in a blind trust. So I don't think they can ignore it, but I think it would be far more detrimental at this point, in my opinion, to, you know, throw Morneau under the bus. I think they need to keep weathering this storm. It's going to be a long storm. It's like Christmas came early for the opposition. But they should expand that key messaging, but I think they need to show unity. And I think that also speaks to the point, I understand why Trudeau, is speaking to this issue. He's trying to show the message, you know, the buck stops here. You know, I have confidence in the minister and, you know, our party's transparent. And that's why I'm here speaking to this issue. But I think they need a hybrid approach. People need to see the minister talking. They need to, you know, there needs to be some accountability.
So that begs the question then, is Morneau making a tactical error by not showing up in Question Period at all this week? Apparently his staff tell me he's going to be in the House tomorrow, but that's 3 days drags on.
I would say so. I would advise that he be there.
Yeah.
And the prime minister can answer some questions, but they need to hear Morneau talk. I think, you know, in theory, the approach can work. But I don't think it needs to be black and white, and I think it's becoming a little bit transparent. So I think they can weather the storm, but I think there needs to be a little bit of a reversal in terms of how they're approaching it.
Looking down the road, I'm just thinking of the longer-term optics of the prime minister defending a finance minister with $40 million worth of shares,
right. Yeah.
And he's pulling in $100,000, more than $100,000 a month in dividends,
yep.
And it's in a company that could be loosely seen yep. to be benefiting.
Yep.
How long does that optic hang around after this is over, and I assume this has an ending.
A long time, and I think there's going to be some repercussions as a result of this whole mess, and it's beyond just the finance minister, you know, not putting his assets in a blind trust. It's the small tax reforms and then the transition in terms of what that policy looks like. Mm-hmm. And I think people are very, you know, hesitant of a minister who could be, whether or not he is looking hypocritical in terms of his approach.
Well, we'll keep you on Rolodex call here and see if we can come in and see if this thing changes. Because
I'd be happy to.
I didn't know repetition was 101 communications
Shocking.
Crisis. All right. Thank you, Jennifer.
No
Appreciate
problem.
That. So did the prime minister do a good job of handling the pressure question period today? Well, let us know what you think. You can reach out to us through social media on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. And you can also contact us via our email address. That is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Well, the finance minister retreated to a small town in New Brunswick to announce he was calling down most of the restrictions on passive investments in smaller corporations. Here's what he had to say in announcing a new damage control strategy against the outcry from his tax changes.
Getting it right is important. We think we've gotten it right, and we don't think there's another process that would have allowed us to get that input to get to the best outcome, which is where we believe we are today.
Well, to reality check the retreat, we're joined from Washington by Perrin Beatty. He's the former cabinet minister, and he's president of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Beatty, I got to ask you a quick question on this. Does business, in your view, have any shaken confidence in the finance minister from all these ethical questions that are being raised?
Well, let's focus on the announcement for today rather than getting into issues which are a bit more political. The announcement today was a good announcement. So from that perspective, the business community is pleased.
All right. Well, you colorfully called this the Dance of the Seven Veils. And as you said, they did make an announcement on easing these restrictions on passive investment inside these incorporated businesses. Is that problem solved in your view?
Well, what we've seen all day, all of this week, is each day they are taking down another veil, and you see a little bit more of what they have in mind in terms of how to repair the damage that was done with the package announced in July. We've got more of a sense today as it relates to passive income. It's good news for, if you accept their figure, that 97% of businesses won't be affected as a result of this. That's good news, but still we don't have the details. And we need to know exactly how this is going to be done and what the impact is going to be. The other thing that the government needs to do is to have a full economic impact statement where they look at the whole of the package. For example, the tax cut that was announced on Monday, it was clear that that was not anticipated at the time the budget was produced mm-hmm. back in the spring, nor was it anticipated at the time that they announced the package in July. So this is something which has come to mind very recently. What is the impact of that upon the federal revenues? What is the impact of that upon job creation and investment and so on? And then what are the impacts of each of the other elements that they've put in place? Until we get that sort of an economic impact assessment, it's very hard to understand exactly what the full impact will be.
I know, and you're a former politician, as I mentioned, but I just sort of wonder if at the end of this exercise in walking backwards, that small business won't be a lot better off than before we even started making these changes. Isn't that an ironic possibility?
Well, the irony in this case is that, you know, very clearly that tax cut to 9%, which had been promised in the election, had been deferred. It was not in the federal budget last spring, and it sure wasn't part of the package they announced in July. My strong suspicion is we wouldn't have seen it this week if it hadn't been for the need to respond to the public outcry over the July package.
Right.
So. From a small business perspective, there is certainly good news here.
Yeah, Christmas came a few months early on that front. I guess I'm wondering what you think this speaks to in the future. What should be done differently? It sounds like it was a failure to consult and a failure to communicate. Is that the lesson here?
Well, absolutely. But beyond that, what do we need at this point? We need to have a full review of our system. The Prime Minister said on Monday that the problem isn't individuals, it's the system. I agree entirely. We need to have a full review that looks at, is our tax system too complex? It is. What can we do to simplify it? And what can we do to ensure that we are competitive with other countries? I'm in Washington today. The Americans have embarked on the most massive tax reform package in our lifetime. Their goal, whichever political party they represent, their goal is to have a tax system which improves the competitiveness of the American economy. We need urgently to have that sort of a review done in Canada at arm's length to government, and then to have the government act.
Right. Final question, since you are in Washington, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is going all out to convince the Trump administration not to abandon NAFTA, and it almost sounds like they're banging their heads against the White House wall. Do you fear the battle to renegotiate is lost or slipping away from us?
I am certainly more pessimistic after being in Washington this week than I was, say, last week. When the USTR said yesterday that he was surprised and disappointed at the reluctance of his negotiating partners to buy into the proposed changes, well, what he's asking for is, we'll take the sun, the moon, the stars, and your firstborn. I'd be reluctant too. Mm-hmm. What they're proposing is a system of mercantilism that goes back three centuries. That's not how you modernize the agreement.
All right, Parambidi, doesn't sound very optimistic from your point of view, but we appreciate your thoughts on all these. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Sure.
See you soon.
Coming up, NAFTA gets a favorable lifeline to Congress, but does it really matter? Our expert is standing by. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, our trade officials are back home recovering from a bruising third-round marathon of NAFTA talks to prepare for the fourth round next month. But a congressional report out today was largely favorable to an important Canadian position on this. For more on all things NAFTA, we're joined from Washington by Chris Sands. He's director at the Canadian Center, or the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Chris, it seems like we won't back down. We won't walk away. The U.S. is making outrageous demands for change. Where's the pathway forward to an agreement in all this mess?
Well, I think now we have all the big demands. We have to find a way to compromise. The U.S. wants 85% content on autos, 50% reserve content just for the U.S. content. That's too high. I think the response in Washington was that's just not doable. But how much is doable? Can we raise that threshold to say 65-70%? And I think that's what everyone is going to spend the next week, 2 weeks doing, running the numbers, trying to see what would be survivable, how far can they go towards meeting what the U.S. wants. And I think the U.S. is going to get a fair offer back. That's certainly an indication that the Mexican and the Canadian negotiators have given us. It'll be up to the U.S. then to decide whether it can accept that compromise. And I suspect by the time we get through the next round and maybe the one after that, we'll start hearing some much more reasonable things from all sides.
All right, so this was the standoff round. Now everyone realizes what's on the table and who's serious about what, so you got to go find the compromise room. Is that what you're looking for?
That's what I'm looking for. You know, it's funny, we always say NAFTA was negotiated and there wasn't an internet, so there wasn't e-commerce, and so we need to have a digital chapter. Fair enough. And that's actually one of the things the three teams generally agree on. But I think what people forget is we also, when we negotiated NAFTA, didn't have social media. We didn't have all of the outrageous demands and theatrics of trade negotiations sort of broadcast into our living rooms where we all were looking in horror and saying, how are they ever going to come to a deal? This is a different kind of negotiation. I think you have to kind of go with the style, which involves all of these crazy demands, but then you start getting down to compromises and it seems a lot more realistic at the end of the day.
Yeah, I see an interesting report sort of from the Congressional Research Service. It says there's no way to eliminate these trade deficits with Mexico, which is what Trump says this is all about. So the only real reason he wants to renegotiate NAFTA. Do these reports help our position at all, or the president's just immune to listening to it?
No, I think they do. Not so much because the president does or doesn't listen, but because they're the basis for trying to figure out how do we then deal with the issue. So I'll give you an example. On currency manipulation, for a long time, people argued the Japanese were manipulating currency, the Chinese, and the IMF spent a long time studying it and came up with a formula that says, well, this kind of fluctuation within these parameters, that's okay. And there are lots of ways to figure out if that's normal and so forth. But if it's outside that band, if it really stretches up or down too far, then you've got currency manipulation or you likely have it. That was really useful. And I think what the Congressional Research Service is starting to get us to is an understanding that, yes, you're going to have fluctuations in trade deficits. If the oil price goes up real high, then you're going to see Canada having an advantage over the U.S. just because of the cost of oil. But what's the difference between those normal fluctuations and a systematic deficit that is causing perhaps problems? And I think if we can come up with some sort of way of understanding deficits and when they're too extreme to be tolerated and when they're just the normal ebb and flow, it won't so much matter in North America, where I think we have relative balanced trade. But what the U.S. keeps saying is they want to use the new NAFTA as a template for other agreements. And there are going to be relationships where you have big swings that are more concerning. So maybe this Congressional Research Report helps us to understand better, you know, what's in bounds and what's really unusual and needs to be addressed.
All right. In a couple words or less, Chris, what are the odds we're going to have a NAFTA around this time next year?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually think we'll get through NAFTA 2.0. But we'll probably have a NAFTA 3.0. There's some great issues we haven't talked about yet, like labor mobility and some things we really need to think about. I just don't see that happening in the tight time frame now, but I do think we'll be talking about NAFTA for some time to come. Just we'll have a short NAFTA and then we'll have NAFTA 3.
You know what that means, Chris? You and I will be talking along for a long time yet. Thanks very much for joining us.
Excellent. I'll look forward to it.
All right, coming up, the unveiling of religious expression in Quebec. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, Quebec passed the controversial religious neutrality law earlier today. It would ban face coverings of all kinds when accessing public services, which includes like library visits or bus transit rides. Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould had this to say about the bill just moments ago.
Individuals should be free to wear what they want, and our government is committed to ensuring that we uphold the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But we recognize that a conversation took place in the National Assembly in Quebec, and they've passed laws, and that is their prerogative to do so.
All right, for more, we've reached Robert Leckie. He is Dean of Law at McGill University. Mr. Leckie, any doubt in your mind that this is targeted at Muslims?
No, it seems pretty clear, Don. If you look at the legislative history, all the discussions leading up to this, on its face, it applies to everybody. But we all know, I think, what the face covering issue is and which religious community it's associated with in Quebec.
Absolutely. Now, there's going to be an exemption. But I'm curious what that means. Like, will a bus driver be able to decide if he can let a kneecap passenger aboard or even someone wearing a baklava in January?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's really not clear how the thing's actually going to roll out now it's been adopted. The law provides a starting point that people have their faces uncovered, and then it provides that people can have an exception from that. And so, yeah, it would seem to be that the frontline providers of public services are going to have to kind of adjudicate whether or not to grant this exception.
Yeah, so there's no guidance in the bill as to whether that person wearing a scarf in January is going to be